Please pray with me, O Heavenly Father. Divine Mother. Beloved Jesus Christ. Blessed Master. Dearest Mother. Saints and sages of all religions. I bow to all of you. Free my life from all obstacles. And give me physical, mental, and spiritual development. Make my mind thy temple.
Make my heart thy altar.
Make my love thy home. Be thou the only king. Reigning on the throne of my consciousness. Amen. Last week I read some Treasures Against Time, which is the writings of Drs. And Mrs. Lewis, and thought it would continue. It's such a wonderful description in Master's life, their description of him first coming to America. It is said that Dr. Lewis was Master's first disciple. I don't know if that's true, but he is certainly one of the early ones, and he and Mother were great friends. And so he's a wonderful, wonderful soul. Mrs. Lewis here refers to her husband as Minnie, his name. Several months before we were married, Minnie was interested in buying an Esty organ. These organs had an electric pump attached to the right side of the organ, boxed in such a way as not at all unsightly. Minnie finally decided on the model he liked at the time. After we moved into our new home, it was delivered to a two-manual, full-pedaled organ in a golden oak case. At 19 Whitman Street, we have a living room, den, dining room, kitchen, three bedrooms, and a bath. We had our furniture all selected and paid for. A gracious walnut bedroom suite was given to us by my mother and father. I had made the curtains of scrim, hem-stitching them by hand. We lived in this house for a year and 3 months and decided it was too big. A small two-apartment house was being built next door by Grandpa Lewis, and so we swapped houses. Bradford was just 7 months old. In this house at 23 Whitman Street, we had one bedroom and a den. We were certainly short-sighted, for in April 1919, Brenda was born. Then we were cramped for room. It's wonderful, something that Brenda had written later on, and she said that she grew up with Swami Yogananda as almost a daily visitor to the house. And at the time, she just assumed everybody had a Swami in their house. So, when Bran was 3 months old, we bought the house immediately in back of us at 24 Electric Avenue, where we had three bedrooms, two baths, and a wonderful playroom for the children. This is the house that Master liked so much. Here we had a large kitchen, well-supplied appliances, a large stove, sink, and pantry. How many Hindu dinners came out of this kitchen to serve the many Hindu friends of Master? This was a house that had a lovely back porch where Master and Doctor would sit in the warm evenings and drink Master's limeade. We stayed in this house from June 1919 to November 1926. The big problem was we moved from 19 to 23 Whitman Street was moving the Esty organ. After the carpenters were consulted, it was decided to move the organ across the bridge on the second story between the two houses. This took place on a cold day in January. It was accomplished, but what a hazardous piece of work. For the next move, the oak organ was sold. A larger mahogany model was purchased and delivered directly from the Esty Company to 24 Electric Avenue. In this house, we had much more room for the organ. When Master was with us, he loved to play this organ. He would open all the stops. I think his favorite chant was, "None can tone me." I often would say, "We will have to move if you play so loud." With the windows closed, you could hear that organ a block away. On the bedroom level, there was a beautiful white tile bathroom. Using a circular shower tub, a shower in the tub. What an attraction for Master. As such, a facility would have been unknown in India. I can now understand how Master loved this shower and bathroom. After his daily morning shower, I would attempt to clean up. Water was everywhere, and towels were loaded with water. Being inexperienced in marriage, I was certainly easily discouraged about how easy it was to keep the home clean. After this daily bath, Master would come downstairs, all enthusiastic about cooking some tasty Indian dish for doctor's lunch. Then in the afternoon, we would start cooking for the evening meal, very often serving guests dinner. After the evening meal, doctor and any guests would sit around the table until the wee hours of the morning, and Master would tell stories and discuss Hindu scriptures. Can you imagine such a thing? There were all sorts of discussions. One evening, we had Wilbur Lewis family, doctor's older brother, and other guests to dinner. After dinner, there was a telephone call for Swamiji. In this house, the telephone was in a playroom right off the kitchen. During the dinner, Wilbur Jr., then about 6 years old, did not feel too well, so we put him on the couch in the playroom. After the dinner, we were all seated around the table. No doubt Swamiji was telling us an interesting story when the telephone rang. The call was for Swamiji. Taking the telephone from the table at the head of the couch, Master sat down. He was talking away when suddenly this young Wilbur cried out, "You're sitting on me." Swami jumped up, telephone in hand. How he laughed. He ended his conversation and then came back to the dining room to tell us all about how startled he was to hear, "You're sitting on me." When the weather started to get warm in the spring of 1922, Swamiji would often ask doctor to take him out to visit someone, or they would drive to the outskirts of the city and find a quiet spot to meditate under the stars. One such evening, they drove off to a nearby reservation called Middlesex Fells, a state park. I wonder if that's supposed to be false. In a heavily wooded area that had an observatory. They had been there before, where they meditated at the top of the wooden structure on the hill, from which one could see the city lights of the city of Boston. At this time, Doctor had a Stanley steamer, a 5-passenger auto touring car. No car ever gave a smoother ride. Master certainly did enjoy riding in the evening, especially when the weather was warm. As it was not quite possible to drive this parkway, Doctor parked the car on a street nearby the entrance. As for me, I was at home with the children. The hour was late, and I was concerned about when Master and Doctor would be home. At this time, I answered a call on the telephone. "Medford Police Station calling. This is Lieutenant so-and-so. Is this Mrs. Lewis?" "Yes, sir." "Do you know where your husband is?" "No, sir." "We found his car, a Stanley steamer, on the street, Middlesex Fells entrance. We were concerned about his leaving it there, as a group of young people were coming from a dance. We saw a pair of binoculars lying in the back seat. And so rather than have it damaged in some way, we towed the car to the Medford Police Station. When your husband contacts you, please give him this message." The hours slipped by. I remember so well how I kept going out to the front piazza to see if I could see the two foot travelers coming up the hill. Finally, in the distance, I could hear the trudging feet and voices. They were coming up the hill. When they got to the house, I opened the door and said nothing. We all sat down. I could see how weary they were. When I told them about the Medford Police Station, called about midnight, it was now about 2 a.m., and said the car was at the station, of course. They were relieved to know it was not stolen. Poor doctor, he had to walk 5 more miles to get the Stanley Steamer with the binoculars still in the back seat. Swamiji and I sat up and waited for the doctor to return. Doctor told us how he was cross-examined at the police station about his whereabouts, and we all had a good laugh over it. After a light meal, we all retired for a good night's rest. And then something from Dr. Lewis. That was Mrs. Lewis. In the spring of 1921, around April, we decided that we would take a few days and travel up to the North Shore, as it is called, of Massachusetts, to a summer home of Sister Yogmata, and there spend a few days. Those of you who know New England realize that in April, the North Shore is very cold and very disagreeable. But we went there, and although it was a summer house, we thought we could keep warm and build fires. So off we started. We arrived there, and as evening came, the fires were lit. I remember Master said that he saw us rubbing our hands together and saying, "Ooh, ooh, ooh," and he wondered just what that was. But he said, "I found out all right later that night." We went to bed. He had lots of blankets. He got in with clothes, shoes, and all. During the night, in the intense cold and dampness, he pulled the blankets up over his head and neck, and it was quite a sight in the morning to see his feet sticking out below the blankets. I remember that he said then, "Now I realize what you meant by, oh, oh, oh." The next day was clear and sunny day, but as I have said, at that time of year, it is still cold and penetrating. There was a nice breakwater which runs out from the beach in front of the cottage in which we stayed. As we were walking up and down the beach, the master and I discussing spiritual things and talking about God, he suddenly spied this breakwater made of huge granite blocks. And he said, "Let us meditate, doctor. This is a wonderful place by the ocean." So we went out on the breakwater and sat down and started to meditate. The tide was out, and we were safely perched up on the rocks. That was my first experience of any kind of meditation, especially under those conditions. Well, the first hour, I don't believe there were any rocks any harder than those rocks, but I somehow hung on, saying, "If the Master can sit here, I can sit here, even if it kills me." And so, as I said, after about an hour, my body became numb, and by the grace of God and Master's help, I was able to stay there. And you know that we stayed there for 5 hours. Suddenly, I was aroused by Master saying, "Doctor, doctor, doctor, let's go, let's get out of here." The waves were coming up, breaking around those big stones, and so we got out from that precarious position. Although it was quite an ordeal, it was a great blessing, because after that effort I made, thereafter, meditation was not a hardship, but my efforts were made much easier by the endurance of that discipline. And so I always remember the 5 hours on the breakwater at Plum Island, Massachusetts. A short time after the Master's arrival in Boston, he began to give Sunday lectures in a little hall near Copley Square, known as Felton Hall. After the Sunday lectures, I would go to his room where he would cook little dishes for me. We would discuss God and the great ones and such things, and then usually he would come out to the house and stay during the week until his lecture on Thursday night, his Thursday night class. During those times, many nights were spent in discussion and in listening to the stories of his life, which came out later in his autobiography. I remember that one Sunday evening I had gone to his room. He was preparing food when the telephone rang, and I answered it. Mrs. Lewis had called me to tell me that my little daughter had just had another convulsion. I had schooled her in the necessary things to do in these cases, but she called me, and the Master sensed something was wrong. I remember he said, "What is it, doctor? What is it?" Well, after talking with Mrs. Lewis, I hung up the phone and told him that my daughter had another convulsion. I remember how his face changed. He stepped behind a little screen which separated the kitchen from the rest of his room. It was only a few minutes before he came out his face bathed in smiles, and he said, "Don't worry, doctor, she'll be all right, and she will never have another." I remember that night after we finished our meal and talked a little bit and went to my home. The master sat by my daughter's crib all night, and of course she never had anything like that happen since. And so it is those things and many other things which I tell you, which make us realize how blessed we were to have Master present with us in our home. As I have said, many nights were spent listening to his wonderful words and his experiences and romping around the house as brothers keeping Mrs. Lewis in a state of turmoil, which seemed to be just what we wanted. But in spite of all those things, the wonderful reverence and devotion was never tainted in the least bit, and the master was our master in spite of the close relationship. I remember one occasion when I slept with the master. He asked me to sleep with him. Well, I thought that was all right. Later, I remember he told me that one of the greatest honors that a disciple can have to sleep with his master. And so the days passed on when the hot weather began to come. Many hours on hot days we spent discussing God and the great ones. I remember sipping the wonderful limeade which Master made, which he alone could make in just the right way. In those days of being with him, enjoying great quantities of limeade certainly will never be forgotten. And so the stories continue, but I'll stop there. Isn't that wonderful? And to think of being with this great Hindu spiritual master coming all the way from India. And that we continue to be beneficiaries of all that he sacrificed, all that he did for coming here. We see the great buildings, and the wonderful grounds that Self-Realization Fellowship keeps. And now, perhaps, the great amounts of money and so on that they have. The master started out very simply when he started his school in Ranchi. It was just a mud hut, really, that they started with. And they had many great difficulties, and mosquitoes were in great abundance. But they kept on and they persevered, and gradually, master grew it all. And then he had this feeling, this sense that he was coming to America, that there is something tied up in his destiny with coming here. And yet he felt somewhat mixed about it. He was concerned about the materialism of the Western heirs, and would that take him up and take him away from God? Mother said that one time, Master said that he had gone 5 days without thinking about God, and she said, she didn't even believe it, that that could happen. But that's how he told the story. And he finally sat down to meditate on God. And he said, "God, you're keeping me so busy here. And that unless I'm able to meditate on you and keep you first and foremost, I don't want anything to do with any of this." He had freedom in spirit. And this is the greatest freedom that we can have. And then once having that freedom, and if we choose to continue to stay in a body, then we serve this world in the best way that we know how. And he served this world, and he served all those disciples, all those devotees, and see how he keeps on serving through the books that he had written, through the lessons that he had made available, so that everyone may be able to take advantage of these great things that he came to bring. And the thing is, when a great spiritual master like this comes, it's not just the words that he writes, because embedded within those words is such great spiritual power. And you can feel it as you read the autobiography of a yogi, as you read the different lessons and different talks that he gave. You can feel the spirit, and not even just master spirit, you might say, but the guru lineage that stands behind him, that he drew so deeply upon, that God's infinite spirit, which was channeling itself through him, all of this he brought. And as a result of that, he lifted up so many souls. There's Dr. and Mrs. Lewis. There's his sister, Yana Manta, who was from Seattle. And her husband was a professor at the University of Washington. And meeting him, Master, in 1924 changed her life. And it was just a year later that Mother met Master right here in Seattle as well. And so he came and he lifted up so many, but you know, he had these large gatherings. So many people would come. In those days, they didn't have television. Movies were a rarity even. And so in the beginning, he was entertainment for many people. Here is this interesting man who came from so far away. He's dressed in Hindu clothing. And people would come and listen, and perhaps they would be interested. Perhaps they would get something out of it. But they would go away, and they didn't stay. And he was ultimately disappointed in how many people came and listened to the lectures, but how few really dedicated themselves toward the lessons, towards transforming their lives, and going deeper into meditation. And so he wanted to establish a home base. And eventually that happened in Los Angeles, and there he made a discovery of an old hotel sitting up on a hill called Mount Washington. And one time, the way to get up to that hotel was by a tram. And it's a very steep grade that goes up there. But he was able to buy that hotel because he made a bid on it, which was accepted, but then he had to come up with the down payment. And he didn't have the money for it. And so he was praying to God, "You must see to it that I have the money in order to be able to make this purchase. I know this is the right building for us." And so a woman, an older woman, had a dream the night before this money was due. And if he, Master, didn't come up with it, there was somebody else in line who wanted to buy it. And at noon, it was going to become available if he didn't have the down payment. And this woman had a dream in which she was told to give this certain amount of money to Master. I think she had just met him the once. And she obeyed the dream. She called Master, got in touch with him, and gave him the money. And it was the exact amount that he needed for this down payment. And so he is able to make that down payment. But there's just so many things, sacrifices, difficulties that he encountered along the way. And for us to not give in to whatever it is that seems to oppose us in going to God. We also have Mother as our example. And when she met Master, she grew up in a very poor conditions. And as she grew into adulthood, it didn't improve all that much. Because just before she was to be married, her husband lost his arms in an electrical accident. He was an electrician. And two wires arced, and they arced right through his arms, and he lost them. I think it was just from below the elbows down. And many of her friends said, "Don't marry him. He won't be able to support you." But she felt strongly to marry him, and so she did. And then, consequently, had three children. But she had to earn the money. He couldn't find a job in his condition. And she had these three children, and the doctor finally told her, he says, "I'm going to fix you even without your permission if you don't stop having children, because you can't afford them." And she was a natural mother. She would have had more children if it was just up to her. Reminds me of the palmist in India who read Mother's palm, and he looked at her palm and he says, "Mother, if you have as many children as I see here, you will have a very large family indeed." And I think what he was seeing was all of her spiritual children that were to come to her. But even though her life was very difficult, after meeting Master, as she would say, from that moment to this, I was his. And just everything in her felt the tremendous spirit that was in Master. And she just knew it. She followed it. And she never, even her own father, who was half Native American, and he said, "You would follow that old Indian anywhere." And she said, "Yes, that she would." She felt that way. But her parents weren't pleased. Other people weren't pleased. It's an unusual thing at the time, more unusual even than today. But it didn't dissuade her. And she was loyal to Master through all of those years. I believe it was 27 years from her first meeting. And so these are the things that can inspire us, that whatever our situation is in life, and however difficult we might encounter things, that when we use circumstances in our life to not be defeated, but to draw more deeply upon God consciousness, the strength of God, that we pray more deeply, that we demand of God more deeply. Master carried on a tradition from Sri Yukteswar. And Sri Yukteswar felt, through deep perception, we are God's children. We are made in the image and likeness of God. And that we don't come to God as beggars, but we demand our birthright. We make clear, definitive statements so that we may invoke that image and that likeness, that we have forgotten it. And as a result of that, we wander around in life as if we were alone, without resources, without anything that we may have in God. And that we don't accept that. We don't come to God as a beggar, but we come to Him demanding our birthright. So Master had many prayer demands. And at first, I was uncomfortable with this kind of language because I had been so enculturated into thinking, well, we have to ask God, and if God's grace comes to us, and then perhaps we'll be answered. And no, not to accept that. But to absolutely come to God with clear, definitive statements of what it is that we want, and to invoke that all-powerful, all-accomplishing spirit that comes from God. And when we do this, we open up the doorway so that God's grace may flow to us. Sometimes we think, well, God's grace came to me and lifted me up in that way, or something happened because God's grace, as if God's grace sometimes flows to us and at other times doesn't. And this isn't the way that it is. God showed me very clearly that grace is always flowing to us, only we have shut the door. Our own identification with this body and this persona makes us play small, makes us think small. We have grown into a habit many times of defeatism. And we don't think that we deserve anything more, but this is pure delusion. It's not the image and it's not the likeness of God. We've got to cure ourselves of this. Now, when Dr. Lewis described sitting out on those rocks, that first hour was a very, very long hour. I'm sure that it was. Sitting on those cold rocks, not used to meditating, probably every thought flying through his head of why he should just get up and walk away, but he didn't do it. And he thought, if Master can do it, I can do it. And he made himself stay there. And perhaps some of it was becoming numb and going beyond the pain. But also, as he said, through Master's grace and the uplifting currents that were flowing through him, that this is the way that we can encounter various difficulties that come into this life. We don't accept the small role we've given ourselves. Now, you don't do it out of ego. But you do it because you are, in truth, made in the likeness and the image of God. To begin to rearrange your thinking, You will hear people all the time putting themselves down, minimizing themselves. When something goes wrong, instead of drawing deeper from God, they automatically go into a kind of defeatism. Well, I'm just not very good at that. I don't do that well. I can't do that. Other people maybe can, but I can't. Now, this is not being in the image and likeness of God. It's not drawing upon that great power that certainly exists within you, because each and every human being has that. You think of the great accomplishments that great spiritual masters have done. When Master walked behind that screen and he prayed for this tiny little girl who were having these convulsions. One time it was said that Master was praying for a certain individual who was in a hospital room, and that the people that were sitting in that room noted the time when this happened, and it was exactly the time when Master was deep in prayer. And when Master prayed, he prayed with everything that he had. He didn't hold anything back, and he would demand from God, "You must do this. You must see to it." And that in that room, in that hospital, these people heard a crack right in the room like a loud thunder. And it happened right in that room, and from that instant on, the man got better. Now, sometimes we run up against these opposing forces, and it's a test as to what we do with them. Do we stand our ground? Do we draw more deeply from God, or do we retreat into our little human self in which we feel sorry for ourselves? As I say, we've got to cure ourselves of this. And it's time that we start to live in the likeness and the image of God, and none other. Don't accept the old habits of thinking that you're just this small person, just this little person, this struggling person, this person who doesn't have much. God is constantly flowing to you. If you could imagine, in your mind's eye, a great pipeline flowing from God directly to you and coming from behind you, through the medulla, at the base of the skull, and then flowing into the ajna, and from the ajna distributed to the brain, and from the brain going down through the nervous system. All life, all intelligence, all light, everything that you need, all accomplishing power, is flowing to you and through you. And also materiality, you act like a magnet. And so many of us are magnetized in the wrong direction. If you hold two magnets together, and you do it with the right, correct ends together, they'll draw closer to each other and snap together. But if you reverse one of those ends, they start repelling each other. There's a positive and a negative end to each side. And I'll actually start pushing it away. And too many of us are actually pushing away the very things that we want, even though in the conscious mind, we want these things to come to us. Unconsciously, we're pushing them away. Perhaps it's a thought, I don't deserve these things. Perhaps it's, I don't know what will happen if I get these things. And perhaps if it's a material thing that it is that I'm needing, and I get my material needs satisfied, maybe I'll get swallowed up by this world. And I don't want to get lost. I don't want to become unspiritual. And instead of seeing it all coming from God, you see it from a human ego standpoint, and perhaps I'll forget God. Some people forget God when they're poor. Some people forget God when they're rich. Each one has their own challenge. But if you see God as the all-accomplishing power that's operating in you and through you, and that you must open that doorway so that God can flow in and through you, then you become an open conduit, and grace can always flow through you. There's an unlimited amount of it. And it's not as if God withholds from one and gives to another. He gives to all equally. Jesus told the story of the three men. And each one were given different amounts. One man was given 10 talents, another man 5 talents, and another man 1 talent. And the man with 10 talents took them out, and he invested them, and he made them grow. Another man had 5 talents, and he did the same, and he also made them grow. The third man was given 1 talent, and he thought, I only have 1 talent, I've got to preserve it. So he took it out in the ground and buried it. When the man who had given the talents to these three men came back at some later date, he asked what they had done with it. And so he was told, and he highly approved of the man with 10 talents, the 5 talents, but the man with 1 talent he found fault with, and he took that 1 talent away from him. And he gave it to the man with 10 talents, and you think, well, that's not fair. But it's a principle. And the principle is that when you utilize the life, the intelligence, the power that God has given you, you're given more. You invest it in this world, you give it to this world. You serve in this world. You love in this world. Whatever it is that you take of that likeness and image of God within you, and you expend it out into this world, you let it move through you, you will receive more. If you take it and you bury it in the ground someplace, then even that which you have been given will be taken away from you. I remember there's an individual who had been with mother for a long time, and she was in the spiritual group past mother's passing, and she asked somebody who was new who came in and seemed to be kind of at the center of things. And she was jealous of this individual. And she says, well, how did you get this position? How did these things happen for you? And this individual told her and said, I just looked around and saw what needed to be done. And I wanted to be of help, so I started doing it. The one who had asked said, oh, and she just walked away as if she hadn't been given anything at all. And she always felt impoverished in life. And because she felt impoverished in life, she felt like she didn't have anything to give. But you see how that's a self-reinforcing cycle. Because she didn't give anything, she doesn't receive anything. Even that which she is given is taken away. And you see people, and they can even be somewhat accomplished in this world, but they have poverty consciousness. And whether it's poverty of money, or poverty in relationships, or poverty in love, because they don't give, they don't receive. And so to reverse that, we must start to give. And the greater that we give, the more that we receive. The more that we receive, the more that we can give, and so it goes. Now this sounds like a very simple principle. But it's much harder to put into action because of those old habits that we have. There's only so much in this world. And if I get a little something, I better keep it. Now, this isn't a prescription against having a savings account. It's just saying that we feel deep within us that we give. We're givers. We look to give. We look to serve. We look to allow God to express himself through us in all the ways that he wishes to. And when we have that feeling, we get joy with the giving. That's the real magic of seva, of service. Is that as we give in the right spirit, we get such joy out of the giving. And we also need to be good receivers. Mother, one time she asked me, she said, you don't like to receive anything from anyone else. And I said, no, it's hard for me to. And she said, when you deny anybody else giving to you, you deny them the joy. She says, don't you feel joy when you give? And I said, absolutely, I do. I love to give. She said, then you deny the joy of that other individual from giving to you. And I thought about it, and I knew that she was right. And what would this world be if we could not give and we could not receive with grace? So she said, Mother said, just say simply thank you when somebody gives something to you. One time, Mother was going to give a gift of some firewood to one of the devotees at Christmas time, and she asked me if I would go and get it. I had a pickup truck. And so I said, yes, of course. I said, why? Let me pay for it, Mother, and it'll go to them in your name. And she said, no, this is something that I want to give. Now, you may say that sounds like ego, perhaps, but that's not the way Mother operated. She just knew, and she was teaching me, this feeling of joy when you give to someone else. One time, Papa Ram Dass was talking, and in the description, Mother Krishnabai was walking by with a huge smile on her face, and she's holding up some rupee notes and showing them to Papa in the victory sign. And Papa was laughing and said, Mataji is never happier than when she's giving something away. She is going to give it to somebody. I love the story of Mataji when there was some people, an individual, a man, who came and said that he was very poor and he couldn't support his family. And so she said, you know, we have cows here and people need milk. Why don't you take one of our cows? We'll give it to you. And then you can milk the cow and you have milk for your family and you can sell the extra. So the man was very happy about this. And he took the cow away, but a few days later he was back. And he said, Mataji, I have no feed for the cow, and I don't have any shelter for him either. Mataji says, we have workers here at the ashram. We'll come. And she brought a large amount of feed, and she brought brought materials and built a shelter for the cow. And then some weeks later, he came back, and he said, Mataji, I have a problem. He said, no one will give me any price for the milk. And I can't make it work by the amount of money that they're willing to give me. And Mataji, in her brilliant wisdom, said, we need milk here at the ashram. You bring it here, we'll buy it from you. And that's the way that she was. And they built so many houses. They built over 200 houses for people in that area. They've done so much for that Ganangad area and other areas as well. When they had the large tsunami, Swami Muktananda was making arrangements to help a village. An entire village was wiped out. The people were all right, but all of their houses were gone from the tsunami. And they went in and they rebuilt the houses and they were helping the people to find new jobs. And they took a long-term commitment. They just didn't come in for a few months and then they were gone. They would stay for 4 or 5 years. Recently, they had massive floods this last year. And there's whole areas up in the Himalayas, whole villages, that the villages were now gone. So they went up, specifically looking for some village that may have been overlooked. And the Tata Trucking Company, a very large trucking company in India, they had adopted one of the villages and said they were going to build the houses, but nobody in the village had heard from the company. So they contacted the company. The company said, yes, we're fully intending on building these houses, but we have to purchase new land. So we're involved in finding the land for this village. Their whole area was just swept away by this flood. Really, an enormous amount of damage in a very short amount of time. And so the ashram, Tata told the ashram, we'll come in and build the houses, you stay, and you help this village get back on its feet and to get all the infrastructure and jobs and everything going. And so they made an agreement, a partnership. But that's the way that they are. Now, we may not have the resources to be able to fund a whole village or anything like it, but God can serve through you. every single day through a smile, an encouraging word. Perhaps you have some money that you can give to somebody who is in need at that moment, or some material thing, some piece of advice, some encouragement. You see, there's so many ways for us to be able to give. And when you have the spirit of givingness, the spirit of allowing God to give through you, and if you can't think of anything in particular, just put God in charge of the project. Say, God, here I am. I'm willing to serve you in whatever way that I can. Now, many people serve through the work that they do. And true, you get a salary perhaps for the work that you do in that way. But it is also service. And when you think of each and every person that you serve, or if you're in manufacturing and you're making things, you're making those things for different people. And when you do it with a spirit of love, a spirit of service, it changes. Suddenly you're no longer grumbling about the work that you have to do. You feel a joy and you feel a love flowing through you. You want to do a good job. You want to do it correctly. And this changes everything. Everything. You're doing exactly the same thing that you were the day before, only your entire attitude and experience around it has transformed. Now, it can be anything from cleaning your home to helping somebody else out to running a large charity. It happens all along the spectrum. But you do it all with a feeling of service to God. You do it all with that you want to do it in perfection for God. And when you do, your whole life will be different from that day forward. Because you will no longer be bored. You will no longer do anything that's mundane. Everything will be surcharged with spiritual power and consciousness and awareness. And you can do the simplest of acts and have it something that is absolutely blissful, memorable, surcharged with the power and spirit of God. So let us look to transform our lives, to really delve deeply into the idea of seva and of service and of giving to God. And if you are not feeling the joy, if you are not feeling God's presence, through your days and in everything you do, you've got more work to do. So that you can feel that, know it, experience it, and become the very spirit of seva, of service. You cannot separate God realization from service to God. The two are so intertwined. As Krishna said, unless you can live in this world without eating and without breathing, you are in the field of activity. And therefore, how and what quality are you in this field of activity? Let us take our lead from the lives of great spiritual beings such as Master and Mother. And feel that tremendous light flowing through you, manifesting through you, guiding you, directing you, fulfilling itself through you. And you know, that's when you can truly detach end from act. The outcome isn't nearly so important. Of course, we do things with the outcome in mind. But the more we're attached to the outcome, in an ego sense, the less joy that we have. When you become focused from moment to moment, exactly as things unfold, being the conscious instrument of God, how blissful is that? How joyful? How uplifting? Let us pray to God. O blessed infinite, Reveal thyself.
Reveal thyself.
In mind, heart, and soul.
In mind, heart, and soul.
No longer be a stranger.
No longer be a stranger.
But an infinite friend.
But an infinite friend.
Who guides me.
Guides me
moment to moment,
moment to moment,
in every aspect of my life,
in every aspect of my life.
Om Shri Ram Jai Ram Jai Jai Ram.
Om Shri Ram Jai Ram Jai Jai Ram.
Victory to God.
Victory to God.
Victory to the light.
Victory to the light.
Amen.
Amen.
Om.